Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much for coming back. As I frequently say, I am not beyond attachment. Therefore, I am happy and comforted when you return. We'll start this afternoon with a short prayer. I forgot it this morning. You get me in a chair, and then I start talking, and you know, anything happens. So as we did last evening, I'll recite the four-line refuge prayer one time in Tibetan as a way of pulling together the aspirations of the group, and so you can join in with your own aspirations. If this is a prayer with which you're familiar, you can recite it along, or chant along. Or if it's a prayer with which you are unfamiliar, you can join in your heart and your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session of practice to the liberation and relieving of suffering for all sentient beings. So we'll begin with that. O Sanje Chudan Sochi Chonamla Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Suchi Daji Jin Soji Be Sunam Ki Trola Penshi Sanje Truparsha. O Palin Sawelama Rinpoche Dagi Chi Or Pede Ten Shula Kadrin Jembo Gone Che Sun Te Kusun Tugging A Trip Sal Du Son. Okay, thank you. This morning, we spoke about, we picked up from where we left off last evening and talked a little bit about Buddha nature and how all beings are endowed with the potential for awakening. And we spoke a little bit about why, if this is the case, we don't experience this awakening every minute of every day. The reason being that our Buddha nature is you could say obscured, only temporarily, by confusion, and that confusion rests as like a mere sheen of ignorance, as Kempo Rinpoche called it, a mere sheen of ignorance. And that if that ignorance is dispelled, that Buddhahood is the result. We spoke about the meaning of the Tibetan word Sanje, or Buddha. Sang meaning completely purified, and Je meaning greatly or completely ripened. And so in this way, the Buddhist path consists of purifying ourselves of negative patterns, karma, habits, and delusion, which then allows the Buddha nature that is naturally occurring within us to manifest. And we spoke about the methodology of this liberation. We began to talk about the methodology for this liberation using the Four Noble Truths as our guide. We spoke about the Buddha's teaching on suffering being part of life, suffering having a cause, the cause being clinging and fixation, especially clinging and fixation to a concept of a permanent, real, and unchanging self-identity. And we talked about the third noble truth, the solution to suffering, which is letting go of clinging and fixation, especially letting go of selfish craving and selfish fixation. And then the fourth noble truth, the path. So using the four statements by the Buddha, do no harm, practice virtue, and tame the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. These three practices, doing no harm, practicing virtue, and taming the mind, are our basic methods for effecting this purification and ripening that's described by the word Buddha or Sanjay. So that was this morning. At the end of the morning, as we did last evening, we did some shamatha meditation as a means for demonstrating the potential we have for letting go. As we observed today, even if you can let go of one single thought in meditation, this is, I guess you could say, proof positive. If you can let go of even just one thought in meditation, that all thoughts eventually can be relinquished, even thoughts of selfish fixation. In spite of all of the distractions that this world has to offer to us, in spite of all of that, we have the potential for Buddhahood at any time and any place through the practice of meditation. So then we introduced the concept of the wheel of life, or the wheel of life painting. We talked about its history, how it came into being. We spoke a little bit about how it may be the very first representation of the teachings of the Dharma, even before the sutras were written down, since it was drawn at the request of the Buddha Shakyamuni during his lifetime. It's a pretty special piece of iconography. And it's a pictorial representation of the path of liberation. And we spoke about how understanding this pictorial representation of liberation can help us to take the path. Remember I said this morning, it's like diagramming a sentence. Remember that from grammar? Diagramming a sentence, it's like diagramming samsara. And by teaching us the way of samsara, we learn how to undo this confusion that we experience in our lives. So that there's great benefit in studying the drawing and coming to understand its symbolism. This morning we spoke about the I guess you could call it the overarching symbolism of Yama, who you could see as holding this wheel. He's talked about both as a representation of wisdom, in that through his display he shows us how we need to practice so that we can accomplish Buddhahood. But then in this particular context, the sort of relative context of Yama, he is the Lord of Death. And death is symbolic. It's the shorthand. The word death is shorthand for all of samsara, for all of the sufferings of samsara. And so we spoke about Yama and his symbolism. We spoke about the wheel and the six divisions in the wheel being representative of six mental afflictions that produce six different types of experience in our everyday life. And so, the fact that the wheel is round indicates that it is continuously moving, and that we have the potential to experience change at any time. So that's a little bit about what we did this morning. The Buddha, standing in the upper corner, is showing the way of awakening. Remember, the text said that he was like a doctor diagnosing the problems of samsara. And he's pointing toward the moon, which is symbolic of the awakened state. So that's how far we went this morning. Now, we may have some folks here this afternoon who were not here this morning. I have copies of the drawing for everybody. So is there anybody who wasn't here this morning who needs a drawing? Anybody who was not here this morning who wants or needs a drawing? Do you want or need a drawing? Do you have a drawing? Okay, good. Everybody? Okay, everybody's got a drawing. Okay, good. So what we'll start with this afternoon is, as I mentioned this morning, we're going to go through the drawing several times. Each time we go through it, we'll add a little bit of detail. So if we go through the drawing this afternoon and you haven't heard everything yet, hang on, because when we go through it the second and the third time, more detail will be added. In the center of the drawing, as we noted this morning, are the symbols of the three mental poisons: attachment, ignorance, and aversion. And so these three animals, the pig, symbolic of ignorance, the snake, symbolic of aversion, and the rooster, symbolic of attachment, are biting each other's tails in the center of the drawing. In effect, you could say that these three poisons, ignorance being the primary, because we are ignorant of our Buddha nature. Therefore, because we're ignorant of our Buddha nature, we take as true all external and internal phenomena. Because we don't recognize that the mind is the author of our experience, because we don't recognize that, we fall into bewilderment and become dazzled by all of external phenomena as well as the internal phenomena. And so that that potential leads us to make a choice. The ring that is outside of that shows the path. The path can begin, if you look at the bottom left-hand quadrant of that circle, which would be somewhere around 7 o'clock if it were a clock face, you see a person making an offering of a lamp. And then they proceed upward through other types of Dharma practice until eventually they achieve a celestial or a higher rebirth. You also likewise see on the right-hand side of the diagram beings being led into bondage and suffering by a slave master at the bottom of the drawing, at the 5 o'clock position. This is symbolic of the negative path of those who choose negative action. So what this means is, because we have essentially power over our future through having power over whether we engage in these three poisons, we have power over that slowly and gradually. We gain power over those three poisons through the practice of Dharma. And as we gain power over them, then we will either rise through the practice of Dharma or fall through the practice of negativity. And so the choice is ours as to which of these we like to take. So that's a little bit about the center of the drawing. Does anybody have questions about the two circles in the center of the drawing? We'll get to the other ones later. Any questions? Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, I can't see the drawing well enough. I can't make out the drawing well enough, so we'll have to wait for another time. Yeah, sorry. I'll look here, but no, it does. It appears to be different in each of the drawings. So. I think you would have to look at the natural world. If we look at the natural world, the pig will eat anything. So it could be considered to be bewildered or ignorant. And the snake strikes. So it strikes with ferocity. And so you could see how it might be the symbol of anger or aversion. But if you've ever watched a rooster protect his flock of hens, you will know something about attachment. Because again, if you look at the natural world, these again are not absolute symbols, they're just representation. And so if you look at the jealousy and the attachment that the rooster has for his and possession for his particular flock of hens, and how he'll fight anybody for those hens, you know, you can kind of see a little bit from the natural world. So that's my best guess. That's my best guess. Other thoughts? Yes. The picture, if I remember correctly, it might have been from Kala Rinpoche's book, but it might have also been from another book. I apologize. I don't know. I usually put the name of the book at the bottom, and I didn't here. So the second drawing I'm going to hand out is from Kala Rinpoche's book, Luminous Mind. But I'm not sure if that's where this drawing came from. As you know, anybody who's seen these pictures, there are at least 5 or 6 or 7 variations of this picture. There are many, many variations. So, but unfortunately, I can't tell you which book it came from. The second drawing, I can, because it came from Luminous Mind. I already marked that. Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
Regardless of the variation, it might be, you might find in the various drawings.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to look at the drawing that's on the flyer. Yeah, thanks. Oh yeah, it is. It is very well demarked here. Yeah, and in fact it is pretty well marked off. I can't say that it's always the same. I wish I could. But there's so much variation in the drawings. And the drawings I've seen, the majority of them show the positive path on the left and the negative path on the right. But those don't have any relationship necessarily. I mean, I would need to have a scholar here. And unfortunately, you didn't get a scholar today. Yeah, so it's like, but I can. We can ask the. If somebody would like to start writing down the questions that we don't have answers for, we can ask one of the lamas if anybody wants to volunteer to do that. The question is, what are the representation? What are the drawings of the? Positive and negative path, what's the symbolism, and are they always positive on one side and negative on the other side, and is it right or left, and if so, what's the significance? I think that's a long way of saying a short question. Okay, thanks. Why the rooster? I think we're okay with that. Yeah, there is some type of higher. Are you talking about the second circle in the center? of the up and down. Yeah, I can't necessarily say that they have to do much with the bardo. I can't say that because I don't know. We can make suppositions, but I really couldn't say. Yes. Yeah, I wish I could say. I don't remember. Yeah, I don't recall. Other things that people would like to say about the first and second circles? Oh, yeah, I know it's not easy. Do you need something? Is there something that you're lacking?
No.
Oh, okay, got it, okay. Okay, yeah, all right. So, okie doke. Then I guess if it's okay, we'll go on. I'm going to read again from this small Australian publication about the three poisons and the two paths to give additional information, and then we'll move outward into the six emotional states. This is very interesting. As long as the pig of ignorance is engrossed in the dung heap of confusion, it ignores all appearing phenomena. It ignores that all appearing phenomena are complexes resulting from causes and conditions and not solid realities. Based on the assumptions of such ignorance, we develop likes and dislikes, and consequently strategies of attachment toward what we like and strategies of aversion toward what we don't like. These three poisons, ignorance, attachment, and aversion, form the basis of our actions. Whatever we do under the influence of these, our thoughts and actions are consequently poisoned, and it follows that the results will be painful. This is the basic outgrowth of the quotation that we shared from the Dhammapada. If we think, speak, and act with an impure mind, that is, the self-centered mind, suffering follows. And if we think, speak, and act with a pure mind, happiness follows. That puts the causes of happiness and the causes of suffering squarely in our own hands, in our own experience. So that's a little bit about the three poisons. The fact is, when our actions are influenced by these poisons, the results are not going to be so good, because they will take us farther away from enlightenment and deeper into samsara. We'll be going in to the center of the circle rather than away and out from it. The two paths are explained this way. Our experiences are results of our actions and the motivations behind those actions. So that's a good first statement. What we experience is the result of our actions and the motivations behind those actions. This is known as the law of cause and effect, or karma. When we engage in negative actions based on ignorance, attachment, aversion, these will generate painful results corresponding to these negative attitudes. For example, I often tell the story of a woman I worked with who was very much of a gossip. She loved to tell the dirt on all the people in the workplace. But her biggest fear was that someone was gossiping about her. So in that way, she created her own reality by what she was thinking and what thoughts she entertained on a regular basis. We see this even now in public life, where a certain public people think that other people are doing bad things when they themselves are also doing bad things or have done them in the past. We see this all the time, where people project onto others their own bad actions. And it's because their bad actions have created a state of mind within them where they're always suspicious of other people, because they think that other people are doing what they're doing. So as a result, you could say we create the world we live in by what we think habitually. And so as there are so many good examples of this in the world today where we see people creating their own environment, essentially, by how they think. And so it stands to reason then that when we also engage in positive actions, when we're kind to others, when we are generous to others, that creates an openness in us, a relaxation, an openness, a stability inside of us. I call it conditioning the mind with virtue. Conditioning the mind with virtue. I mean, we condition our skin, we condition our hair, you know, we condition everything, but we're always conditioning our minds. And if we are kind and generous and patient and loving toward others, this conditions how we experience others and how they experience us. So again, you can create a world of happiness or a world of hurt depending on how you think and how you look at things. So I'm going to continue reading. In contrast, when we are motivated by light sentiments such as kindness, empathy, and generosity, these virtuous mind states will result in the corresponding positive experiences. Destructive actions bring about rebirth in what are called lower realms, while light or selfless or ethical actions bring about rebirth in the upper half of the wheel of existence. You see, the wheel of existence, we haven't quite gotten to those six divisions yet. But they roughly are divided into half, with the lower half of the circle being negative rebirths and the higher part of the circle being higher rebirths. But some of them cross over, as we will see when we look at the individual mind states. So it says here, let's see, this might actually have some of that black and white information. Let's see about it here. The black and white semicircles illustrate the ramifications of actions within, of actions, with the white semicircle showing persons ascending and the black semicircle showing persons descending. While on one hand, this image illustrates the responsibility for an individual's actions, it also establishes how an individual is empowered to create his or her own destiny in samsara. For this reason, Buddhists emphasize the importance of accumulating virtuous mind states and discarding evil mind states, and place great importance on even the smallest ethical and meritorious action. The verse that you see at the top in Tibetan is from the Vinaya, the Buddhist scriptures on discipline, and emphasizes the importance of ethical behavior. So the meaning of that that phrase, that little legend at the top on the upper left-hand corner in Tibetan is this: to shun even the slightest evil, to fully embrace virtue, and to master the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So these are the four statements. Yeah. To shun even the slightest evil, to fully embrace virtue, and to master the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So I paraphrased it in a slightly different way, but that's the meaning of that verse that's in Tibetan at the top of the picture. Okay. Now onto the six divisions. You know what? Before we do that, I think we're going to meditate. I promised folks that I would put a little meditation in this class. So you have your choice. You can either do some shamatha practice, learning how to let go of a thought in the moment, or you can take time to reflect. on the choices of ethical or unethical behavior that we have every day, and make an aspiration to choose ethics. We'll meditate for about 2 or 3 minutes. Placing the body in the posture of meditation, we start with the attitude of wishing to benefit beings and practicing meditation for their benefit. Begin with one deep breath. Breathe out. And then allow your attention to come to rest on the breath as you breathe naturally. Any questions about meditation while we're here? Okay, just checking. Okay, as I mentioned, the diagram shows us how confusion happens. And I was thinking I was going to talk about the next... I think I will. I'm going to go ahead and talk about the six divisions next. Remember I said that that when we follow or pursue thoughts, that we are for that moment reborn in the world of that thought? We talked about this last night and this morning, that whenever a thought arises in our mind and we buy into that thought, it's as though we take rebirth in that place, whatever that thought is. We are maybe reborn in for just a moment or two in the world of, oh, that person hates me, or oh, I hate that person, or oh, I love that person, or oh, that person is wonderful, or we're just, or oh, I really want that thing. And so when we follow or pursue a thought, it's as though we become consumed by it. And so being consumed by it, we sort of experience it as though it were a whole little world until the thought disappears and changes into something else. And I think we can see this really clearly when we meditate, when we're sitting on the cushion and one of those big, ugly, hairy thoughts comes up. And for a moment, it distracts us. And for that moment that we're distracted by that big, ugly, hairy thought, we might feel terrified, or we might feel really happy or whatever if we're inside that thought. But the moment we let that thought go, that reality dissolves. And this is the impermanent nature of all experience. People sometimes, because I guess it's the outfit, people sometimes like to tell me about their dreams. And I frequently tell the story of how my previous dentist told me one time about his dreams. I had just come back from 3-year retreat. And you know, when you don't have dental care for 3 years, you got a little work to get done. So I'm sitting in the dentist chair. And he, for some reason, he just starts talking about, he knows that I've been on 3-year retreat. He knows that I'm back and getting looked at. And he starts telling me about his dreams. He said, boy, I had the strangest dream the other night. I should tell you about it. And I'm like, aha. And so then he said, well, first I was fixing some plumbing, and then I was seeing somebody I hadn't seen for a while, and then, you know, I was taking my daughter to college and blah, 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 this and that. Apparently, he had just taken his daughter to college, so he was probably roiling inside with different thoughts and feelings about his child leaving home. Anyway, so then I'm all loaded up with hardware, listening to this. And then he says, how many dreams can you have in a night anyway? Like I knew the answer. And then after he had removed the hardware, I was able to answer. And I said, well, you know, how many thoughts can you have in a day? It's the same. It's the same. Because there's a very little difference between... between our experience of our mind in the day-to-day and our experience of the mind in a dream. Because let's say you're having this dream, and in your dream, you're driving your car. And then the next thing you're doing is you're eating your lunch. And then the next thing you're doing is you're talking to somebody who passed away years ago. All of this in the same dream. And it's just that the dream changes like this, and like this, and like this, and like this. Then you wake up from the dream, you get up and wash your face, you get ready for work, you get in your car, and while you're driving in the car, the radio is on and you hear a song and you remember someone you hadn't seen in years, someone who passed away years ago. Then you start thinking, what am I going to have for lunch? And then you start thinking about this or that happened, and it's essentially the same. we don't try to put a narrative or a plot on it if it's happening in a dream. Whereas we try to paint on a narrative when we're doing it when we're awake. I'm just saying, there's really no difference if you think about it. They move just as nonsensically and non-linearly. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is because these little worlds that we are born into don't last very long, but they feel kind of intense sometimes when we have these thoughts and we're swallowed by them. Well, how would it be if it was a longer period of time that we were swallowed up by that thought? Maybe it would be days, hours, days, whatever. Well, then that gets us a little closer to these six states of existence that are described in the next circle in the wheel. These six states are said to be the result of pursuing the six mental afflictions. Now, in this particular drawing, the images are different, but we'll follow them one at a time. In the bottom drawing, in the bottom quadrant, we see Yama again in the center of a very difficult situation. We would call this the experience of hell. This is said to be the result of hatred and anger and aversion. Remember I said last night, sometimes when we're angry, we feel as though we're on fire, and the feeling of that heat rises in our chest. Well, what if we pursued that for a very, 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 very long time? The result of that would be the continuous feeling of being in hell. We have all been there at one time or another in our everyday life as human beings in this lifetime. But what if it lasted a little longer? Then we would have the experience that's being described as the result of anger in the bottom panel. The panel to the right, our right, depicts what are called hungry spirits or deprived spirits. And the hungry or deprived spirits are those beings who are never satisfied, no matter how much they have. They are compared to the deprived spirits of legend, who have tiny little mouths, but a big capacity in their stomach. And they are always hungry, and they're always searching for food and drink because they're feeling malnourished. And whether or not we have ever felt like this, we actually have probably met people who have felt like this. And this is the result of stinginess and miserliness, not sharing, not giving. It's just like my friend the gossip, who was gossiping and thought everybody was gossiping about her. The stingy person is always afraid of not having enough, and therefore they don't give. And this is the existence that they create for themselves, the world they create for themselves, the world of the deprived spirit. That's the little world we could be built in, that we could be trapped in for that moment that we buy into a thought of, I'm not going to have enough. Mine, mine, mine. The image to the left indicates animals. This is the outcome of the mental affliction of bewilderment. Sometimes I call it chosen ignorance, when you choose not to know. And it's symbolized by the animals, which are driven by instinct. not by thought. They're driven by instinct to kill and eat one another. They're overpowered by instinct. A lot of people feel badly for animals because they suffer so much. And I think it's kind of nice that in this world we have so many organizations and individuals who are trying to make the world better for animals. They're trying to make their lives more comfortable, to prevent them being enslaved and tortured for our enjoyment and so forth. And so if we look at the lives of domestic pets in America, we might think that animals have things pretty good. But this is maybe even, this has got to be, has to be less than 10% of the animals in the world. Maybe even less than 1% of the animals in the world are cared for like that. The rest of them, if we consider all the animals in the sea and the animals under rocks and so forth, it's probably way less than 1% live comfortable lives being cared for by people. But then, of course, even the domestic pets in America probably suffer mental suffering. I mean, how many people have owned a dog and the dog doesn't understand why you leave? Why would you? The dog is there. Why would you leave? It doesn't make sense. It would present, I mean, we're barely functional as human beings and we're definitely not functional as dogs because we leave the pack. What's that all about? And the mental suffering that dogs and cats endure is something we can't even guess at. Although sometimes they leave us hints of their mental suffering. Okay, anyway. And so so there's that. Human beings are depicted in the upper right-hand corner. Human beings are working constantly, toiling. They are toiling constantly because of their attachment to comfort. They have to work always, be working 24/7 in order to make ends meet and to provide for their comfort. They're so attached to comfort. And so attachment brings about all of the drama of life. Finding spouses, finding houses, finding jobs, finding this, finding that. Then the quadrant or the corner in the upper left shows two types of existence. The result of pride and the result of jealousy. The realm of the gods and the realm of the demigods. Gods are at the top. They have a lot. You might call them the 1%. You might call them something. There are not too many of them, and they are at the top. They're very comfortable. They have everything they could possibly want, and then some. They have pleasant surroundings and pleasant companionship, and the temperature is perfect. Everything is perfect. They have everything they could possibly want or need. And they feel superior to everyone. So the idea here is that when we practice superiority, I know people talk about the word pride and they talk about the word arrogance. And we might use those words pride and arrogance to distance ourselves from the emotion. To say, oh, I'm not arrogant. I'm not prideful. Oh, that's not me at all. But if we change the word a little bit and use the word superior, now we may occasionally admit to feeling superior. We might feel superior to people we see on television. I have a friend. She's really into watching these judge shows. You know, where people are judging each other for small claims things or bad relationships or being cheated out of something or, oh my gosh, paternity, you know. And I asked her, I said, why do you watch these? Why do you watch these programs? They're kind of upsetting because there's a lot of yelling. And she says, I watch them because I realize that I'm not the worst. It helps me to feel better about my life when I see how messed up other people are. And I said, well, okay, that's one way of looking at it. Okay, it was real for her. It was real for her. She said, I can't believe how stupid some people are. And so forth and so on. So we may feel superior from time to time. We might feel superior to other people. And that superiority puts a distance between us and other people. And that distance can become a harmful distance. A harmful distance in that we might think that it is appropriate to harm people that we feel superior to. We might think, I mean, at the very least, we'll criticize and insult them. The very least. But we would do worse if we had the opportunity. Perhaps. This is why Dharma is so important. We have to train ourselves to not be that way. In the image, in the drawing, you see the gods enjoying lovely home and a beautiful garden where there's a tree blossoming and fruiting. But at the base of the tree, you see others, and these others are armed with weapons. And their weapons are aimed upward at the gods. These are the jealous gods, or the Asuras, are the Asuras. And in legend, the tree is rooted in their country, and it blooms in the realm of the gods. And therefore, they've started a lawsuit with weapons involved. It's like the judge shows. They have launched a campaign they've waged war against the gods because they deserve the fruit of that tree. It is rooted in their country. And therefore, they need to have justice done and have the fruit. And so this legend about a miraculous tree that fruits in one realm and is rooted in another is used to describe jealousy and how we think that we deserve something that others have, and therefore anger arises in us, an anger that is aimed at destroying the other in order to get what we think we deserve. And we've all actually lived in these places. If you believe in Buddhist philosophy, literally we have lived in these places. But if that's a little difficult, we've at least visited those places on a day-to-day basis when we have felt jealous, when we have felt superior, when we have felt ignorant, when we have felt averse, attached, and stingy. We've actually spent some time in each one of these places feeling the result of this negative mental affliction, feeling that pain and the result. And so these being the outgrowth of that little engine of samsara in the center, the ignorance, the aversion, and the attachment, you could say that this is sort of the flowering of those three basic negative mental afflictions as states of being, of states of experience. Some folks have a difficult time with this piece of information. They say to me, well, Buddhism is just like Christianity. There's hell, there's heaven, and there's a lot of stuff in between, but that heaven and hell thing, that bothers me. Why would the Buddha create heaven why would the Buddha create hell? Why would he do that? And of course, I had to say, well, the Buddha didn't create it. He's just describing it very much the same way that Newton described gravity. He did not invent gravity. He just invented a way of talking about it, describing it. So the Buddha didn't invent these states of experience. He just described them. So we can't blame the Buddha any more than we can blame the elementary school teacher that tells us the rules right before we break them. Well, the teacher made me do this, and the teacher did this, and the teacher did that, and they punished me for this, and they punished me for that. Well, they just told you what the rules were, and you broke them. What are you going to do? Is it the teacher's fault? Etc., etc., etc. So, what I have said to people, what I have begun to say to people about this is two things. First, we may not believe that there is such a place as hell, or there is such a place as the God realm or the demigod realm. We may not believe that. But we believe in the experience of heaven. We believe in the experience of hell. We believe in the experience of the deprived spirit. We believe in that experience, and that's enough. If we believe in the experience, then the location in which that experience happens, it's not as important. But I always tell folks that I am in the don't know position, in that I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. The Buddha described it. It probably exists somewhere, maybe not in our way of looking at things, maybe not in our world. But I've seen pictures of places that look like hell to me on this planet. And it's very possible that there are beings that live there we don't see. Very hard to know. So I'm in the don't know position. I'm willing to entertain the notion that there is a place where beings who experience this all the time, we just kind of go in and out of it here in the human realm. We go in to and out of these experiences moment to moment, day to day. But there might be such a place. Could be true. So, discussion, questions, thoughts. Yes?
Okay. As far as that particular truth was, you said six segments.
Right, there's only five there, and that's because what they did was that they combined two into one. The upper left-hand quadrant contains two experiences. The experience of the jealous God realm and the experience of the God realm are in one quadrant, or in one segment or panel. In the color drawings, some of the color drawings are actually divided into six. That's why I'm saying there are so many variations. It's a very popular teaching tool, and so it has lots of variations. More thoughts? Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. They are. Yeah, the question is, I'll repeat the question. I've been forgetting to repeat the question, sorry. But the question is, are the six realms and the six syllables of Om Mani Padme Hum related? And the answer is yes, they are related. In Kenpo Carter Rinpoche's teaching on the Chenrezig and Amitabha sadhanas, in that booklet, he says that each of the syllables purifies one of the negative mental afflictions. And this is drawn, if I remember correctly, from the 15th Karmapa's commentary on the Chenrezig practice. And in the 15th Karmapa's commentary, Rinpoche quotes from that. Om is the purification of pride. Ma is the purification of jealousy. And you can see that it goes from top to bottom, the God realm being the result of pride, and the jealous God realm being the result of jealousy. So these two. Ni is symbolic of the human realm and the purifies attachment. Pei, or pod, but pei, is the purification of ignorance and rebirth in the animal realm. Mei is the purification of stinginess, miserliness, which is the cause for rebirth in the deprived spirits realm. And then finally, Hong, or Hum, is the purification of hatred and aversion, which is the cause for rebirth in hell. So each one of these syllables, and in fact, there are even colors associated with them. If you want to go farther, the Om syllable is white. The Ma syllable is green. The Ni syllable is yellow. The Pei syllable is a light color of blue. Mei is red. And Hong is like a blue-black color. And you can think, Rinpoche, Kempo Rinpoche in his commentary says that as you recite Om Mani Padme Hum, you can think that the blessing of Om Mani Padme Hum purifies you and all beings of these negative mental afflictions. Now you should make sure you tell him that this is not going to have an instantaneous effect. It will not instantly dispel all of these negative mental afflictions, either in himself or in others, because the habits are so strong. The negative habits are so strong. But continue, tell him to continue reciting it, to recite it anytime he feels like it. And like one drop of water, slowly, when you add a drop, add a drop, add a drop, that vessel will get full. There will be an impact down the line. Okay, yeah. That's a good question. Tell him, he's asking good questions. His questions last night were really good too, so go, Mom. Yes. Of aversion or hatred. Was that your only question? Okay, Hilda? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I know what they think their role is. If we look at samsara in general, even in the world that we can see, it's pretty stratified. There's the folks at the top and the folks at the bottom. And that's the way it is in virtually every world that exists. And so the gods are at the top. Demigods wish they were at the top. I think of Hollywood when I think of the demigods. I mean, don't you? Yeah, I mean, you know, because there are all these people who said, I could have won that award. You know, I could have been there. I could have been on that stage, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not sure I'm following your question. What am I missing about your question? Yes, they're actually stuck. Now I understand your question. Yeah. It's kind of bad news for the gods, isn't it? The Buddha's teaching is kind of bad news for the gods. I mean, imagine being Zeus and having somebody say, he's not the top. You think you're in charge of the world? No, thanks. You are not. No, sirree, Bob. You are not in charge. And I think that must have been really hard to hear. I don't know. You know, if they ever heard it, I'm not sure. They may still not know. Go ahead and tell them, but get out of the way. It is a very interesting way of looking at the world, in which it's very interesting. In fact, there's one of the celestial realms, one of the heavenly realms inside samsara, is called the realm of the 33, and it's the 33 gods in, I believe, the Hindu tradition, if I remember correctly, and the names of the gods are just job descriptions that eventually they die, and then there are others who are born as them, as that job. So I don't know all of the Hindu gods, but I do know some of the Greek ones. So it's like whoever is serving as Zeus passes away, passes out of the god realm, and then another one comes up. But they live so long. They live so long. Kempo Carter Rinpoche said there are some worldly spirits who live in every locality. Every locality has worldly spirits living in them that have lived for so long that they are under the misapprehension that they created that world. They're so long-lived that they think they created the world they live in. And that's why when the Tibetans go from one mountainous area to another mountain, they always make an offering of incense smoke or something to the gods of that mountain, because they think they're in charge. And so when you go to somebody's kingdom, you're really nice to them and you give them gifts. And so that's how the Tibetans treat the worldly gods. They don't see them as sources of refuge, because they're not. They're stuck in samsara too. So you can't take refuge in them to lead you out of samsara. Kempo Rinpoche said, if you take refuge in a worldly god and ask and say, oh, please lead me to a Buddhahood, number one, it's impossible, because they're stuck in with you. He says, it's as though you're two people in jail and you say to the other guy in jail, hey, get me out of here. And it's ridiculous. The person you need to get you out of jail is the person outside the jail cell with the key. And so that's why the Buddha is said to be the ultimate refuge, because he's outside. Even in the picture, he's depicted as being outside samsara. It's tough news for the gods, it really is. But they may or may not be listening. But does that fill your question? Other things that people might want to say about the realms? Yes. Yeah, I don't know how it's pronounced either. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So bad that they don't care I know a lot of people who've been there. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad you brought this up, because I think that that you'll see this, that you do see this in the world. You do see this. People who have accumulated a great deal of virtue But they've accumulated that virtue for their own benefit. And they've accumulated the virtue because they think it will give them a better rebirth. And it's not a 100% correct way of thinking, but it's what people do. And you're right. And Kemp Rinpoche said that because that virtue was a little bit tainted virtue, they only get as far as the God realm. And then, as you say, they exhaust their karma, their good karma, and then they have no direction to go but down because they've exhausted. And so I remember something Kemp Rinpoche said when we were in retreat. He said, you can see this happen in the human realm, he said. People who are born into or acquire immense wealth or immense fame. And he said, and then they could lose it in a second. They can, you know, their reputation can be ruined or their money can be squandered or whatever. It's gone, just like that. And he said, you know what uses up your good karma faster than anything? And we all said, no, Rinpoche, what? And he said, fame. Fame. The more famous you are, the faster it burns up your good karma. And so he said, being famous is not all it's cracked up to be. Because he said, and this is why people who are famous should use their fame to do good. Because if they don't use their fame to do good, where are they going? You know, so it really fascinated me. When he was explaining this phenomena, this idea of good karma being exhausted because it was accumulated with some selfish motivation. The selfish motivation is what taints it. And so he said it's like a daylily. Daylily blooms beautifully, and then the next day it's gone. The cause, its energy is all used up, and then it dies. And so it's like that with our good karma. And that's why Kemp Rinpoche frequently at the very beginning when he was first teaching, he liked to tell all of his audiences that they were very fortunate. They had a very fortunate rebirth. All of you, he said, have a fortunate rebirth. Why? Because you have been born in a country that has relative wealth, relative to the rest of the world. Even if you're struggling, relatively, you have more wealth than many. And he said, you have a lot of technological advancement, but you don't have Dharma, and you need that. So, and you've also made contact with the Dharma, so you're in good shape. Now you got to practice. And some of us got the message, and some of us didn't. I didn't get the message for many years. I was kind of a hobby Buddhist, you know. It wasn't until I got into three-year retreat that I started really thinking about those, what they call the four thoughts that turn the mind toward Dharma. Precious human birth. Wow, we are lucky to be human. We could have been born anywhere, but here we are. Second one's impermanence. You got it now, but it won't last. Third, karma is real, and we have to accept that. Fourth, samsara, even on a beautiful day like today, has defects, meaning that when we enjoy the beauties and the pleasures of samsara, suffering is built in and that craving is included. Craving for more is included. So in some ways, samsara is deceptive and defective, and that it will always, in the end, fall apart and disappoint us. So I'm really, thank you again for bringing that up. Did I miss any point that, okay, that was good. Okay, I'm thinking we have a few more minutes, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to meditate for just a few minutes on the six realms, and we'll take a few minutes to do that. And I'd like for you to think about start at the bottom of the drawing, and then consider anger and its outcome, and then look at the deprived spirits and imagine the days and times you've been there. Animal realm, imagine the days and times you've been there. The human realm, what it's like to toil endlessly. The jealous God realm and the God realm. We're going to take about 7 or so minutes and just have a little bit of time to contemplate these realms of existence. You can also conclude your little moments of looking at where you've been with the aspiration, may I and all beings be free from negative rebirth. May I and all beings be free from negative rebirth. So we'll do a little meditation. I won't clutter it up with talking, so I think you can handle it. Last questions or thoughts? Yeah, right. Yeah. It's instructional. It is one of those things, isn't it? Because at first we do look at these six realms and say, well, that's not me, or that's not something I've done. But what's really interesting is a lot of my friends in like the 12-step tradition of recovery, they go through a period of time where they really reflect. They go back and think about their lives, and they look at the things that they have been, the harm that they have been responsible for, causing to others. And I think it's an eye-opener. And I think if all of us did this on a daily basis, where we just kind of looked at our day, like that famous story about the monk who had two bowls on his table, and at the end of every day he put stones in one bowl for every bad thing he did and one stone in a bowl for every good thing he'd done, and then he saw what kind of a day he had had. And I think that, and when you take the Bodhisattva vow, isn't that something you're supposed to do for a Bodhisattva vow? So I've kind of reintroduced a little of that into my life, and it's probably not to the extent it could be, but wow, you know, just taking a look at all those experiences that we have had and all of those things that we have been, said, and done, it can be sobering, but at the same time, liberating, because the Buddhist tradition is full of methods like this mantra we were talking about, Om Mani Padme Hum. And there are other mantra practices and other types of practices, like the daily practice of Buddhist practice of confession. Yeah, Buddhists have it too. And where we think about all of the things that we have done in the last day or so, and we form a feeling of regret for those things we want to purify. And then we recite prayers saying, may this negativity be purified. May I be free, and all beings be free from this kind of mental affliction and negativity. These practices exist, and they're there for our benefit to help us not feel hopeless that we can actually work with and surmount our own negative mental afflictions. We don't have to feel that we are without resources or without methodology. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Anything else? Well, then we're at the top of the hour, end of the day. You've done an amazing thing by being here, and I appreciate it. And I thank you for being here. We'll be here again tomorrow. Folks can start. I believe the doors will open around 10 o'clock, and the program will start at 10:30. We may have extra people here tomorrow because some folks may come from Tiferet Israel over here because the Tiferet program will be shut down tomorrow. So we may have some extra folks here. I don't know what to do about pictures. If you want to use your picture tomorrow, make sure you bring it in your notebook. I'm going to make another set of pictures tonight in case we have another 20 or some folks tomorrow. But if anybody wants to leave their picture behind, they're free to do that, so we can do either way. Yeah, you can also take photos and have them on your cell phone, whatever works for you. So let's sit quietly for a moment and dedicate the merit. We dedicate the merit of this session to all suffering beings. May all beings discover their Buddha nature. And may they be led by teachers through the practices of Dharma. And being led, may they practice. And by practicing, may they gain liberation. And then may they come back and rescue all of us from the sufferings of samsara. I'll recite a short prayer. O sonam deye tam che zipani, tom ne nye pedranam pam chene. Kegana chibalap trupai si pe sole dro ar dro ar sho. Thank you to the team, all of the people.